Hey everybody, just want to give you a quick heads up about the audio you're going to hear today. This was actually recorded on May 22nd. David and John were joined by Patrick Sivek and Jason Barrera. The reason this audio hasn't been released yet is because there were a number of technical difficulties with the audio, places where it cuts out, the calls got dropped. It was just a lot of issues with the audio. So what you're going to hear, there's going to be places where it's going to drop out, and it doesn't necessarily pick right back up. So we have some sort of cliffhangers and things like that. But we decided to release it because it happens in a few places, and it was still incredibly enjoyable for what it was, and still very informative. So I just want you guys to understand that before you go into it. We can always record. That doesn't mean we can always share that with you. We can always try to record, and sometimes it doesn't cooperate. So, and other than that, enjoy the show.
If you have a friend on whom you think you can rely, you are a lucky man. Found the reason to live on and not to die, you are a lucky man. Preachers and poets and scholars don't know it. Temples and statues and steeples won't show it. If you've got the secret, just try not to blow it. Stay a lucky man. A lucky man. If you found the meaning of the truth in this whole world, you are a lucky
so.
Man.
Welcome to Always Report. Today we have Patrick Sivek, and hopefully in a bit we'll have Jason Barrera. Doesn't seem to be quite connecting right now. John, this is Patrick. Patrick, this is John. Although you guys met before, somewhat.
Yes.
On Skype, when you were at my place.
We're familiar enough where we don't need an introduction.
Right. Cool. Patrick, just assembled a new... blog post. Did you put that one up yet, the one that you've been working on? Or
I'm just about to put it up. I just had a couple questions I wanted to ask you, actually.
Okay.
A little clarification on a couple of areas I needed a little more knowledge on.
Can you fill me in on what it's about generally, and then I'm sure you can answer your questions.
Okay. Well, it's about the Beatles, so Lennon and McCartney sort of resonated as these Osirian dying god figures, and the archetypes of, you know, like the hanged man in the tarot. There's a lot of symbolism in their work regarding those archetypes, and I don't know if you've seen Jason's latest post. It's actually ties in with that quite a bit. Which is kind of funny timing-wise, that because I believe he's been working on that particular post that he just did for a year or maybe 2 years, something like that.
All right, so who's who in that relationship? So who's Osiris?
Lennon and McCartney are both. They have lines like...
The walrus.
What was that?
They're always interchanging, right? I mean, they're switching masks, and they're kind of playing on who's who. Who's the carpenter and who's the walrus, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, in one song, John says, I am the walrus, and then a year later, he says, the walrus was Paul. And, you know, like, we're as close as can be, man. And I am he as you are me, you know, stuff like that. And so they're definitely interchanging between this one archetype. They're kind of two distinct individuals, but in a lot of ways one and the same, kind of like Tweedledee and Tweedledum.
Funny.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Have you ever seen Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead?
Yes,
that's a good movie.
Yeah, and you notice how nobody can really tell which one is Rosencrantz and which one is Guildenstern. And, like, even they don't seem to know who is who.
Yeah, that's like the coin that keeps flipping, right?
Yeah, yeah. They flip a coin and it comes up heads 93 times in a row.
That's the number of Thelema, right? So.
Yeah.
That's funny.
And, well, the crazy thing is Gary Oldman is one of those two characters. And Two-Face in The Dark Knight has a two-headed coin. And
he's Commissioner Gordon, right?
Yeah, Commissioner Gordon. And then in The Prestige, Christian Bale has a two-headed coin. So
oh, that's right. I forgot
coins
that.
Running through.
Wow. Oh, and then that's fucking weird. Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. So some of the mind-blowing things going on. There's a tremendous list. So one of the ones that really got me out of many of them was that, you know, so Abbey Road, the photograph was taken. It's within 24 hours if you look at the global clock. How does it work?
Yeah, that photo was taken on August 8th in London, probably around noon, I would guess, probably on their lunch break or something. And so in America, that would probably be like the wee morning hours of August 8th. And so I guess like as the day goes by, London and America are both in August 8th. And so that's the day Manson declared that now is the time for Helter Skelter. And later that night at midnight, which is technically our August 9th, but you know, it's like the night of that day. It's the night of August 8th is when the Sharon Tate thing happened. So it's like, in a way, it's technically all that one same day, but you know, it's after midnight, so it's always attributed to the 9th.
So, yeah, so the same day that Sharon Tate is killed is the day that the Abbey Road photograph was taken. The Beatles are at what is called a zebra crossing, and she is killed at a zebra rug.
Oh yeah, that's right.
and so if you look at there's a photograph, and I can't remember the psychic's name. Do you know the psychic's name?
Oh, I can't remember it now.
Oh geez. Okay. So one of the first things that happens for the police when they come across the scene of Sharon Tate is that they immediately call a police psychic who had solved many cases. He had an 80% success rate. And it's a real case of like call in the psychic. Like it's like, you know, Eric Cartman shows up. It's like, but there's a photograph that was taken, and you know that it had to have been really quick because, you know, Roman Polanski was called right away in France, and he flew out, and it was actually Jack Nicholson and the head of Warner Brothers cleaned up the blood.
Yeah.
So after the body was taken out, they cleaned up the mess before Polanski got there. The pig was still on the door. And so that's interesting in and of itself that you have Jack Nicholson is the one cleaning up the gore. But before before Polanski gets there and before they clean up, there's a photograph taken of the psychic leaning over the scene. And, you know, you can see that, zebra rug is sitting right there, next to where she was killed. And you can find other photographs of her posing on the rug and, you know, kind of, you know, different positions, but, it's very strange that you have this zebra connection. And Patrick went and looked at all of these Sharon Tate films, and sorry to speak about you in the third person, but there's no other way, whereas she just shows up with these zebra rugs and zebra scenarios over and over again. It's really fucking weird. The psychic ended up basically seeing... He goes around the house. They leave him alone. So the police leave, and he surveys the scene and picked up different objects and basically saw that there was a Egyptian orgy ritual, and that there was a game show that had been played, a game where people were saying their last sexual encounter, and the one who had the longest length of time between now and when they had their last experience, got hung, I believe, upside down and beaten. Very strange. And then somebody had a bad LSD experience where they talked to the devil and just some weird shit going on in that house. And then saying one of the killers had been there before for a party, which is something that, you know, no one talks about beyond the psychic, and who the hell knows, but that's what this guy had to say. So kind of interesting.
Yeah, I was just remembering how Agent Cooper hangs upside down in his lodge, in his room, you know, his motel room.
In Twin Peaks? It's Agent Cooper. Is that Twin
Peaks? Yeah, he's in room 315. And he hangs upside down to meditate sometimes. He straps his feet to a chin-up bar with these braces on his ankles and just hangs upside down.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, that was... So, was it Michael Keaton in the original Batman? You know, that's how he sleeps. It's one of those things. It's kind of funny.
Well, you guys talked about that upside down archetype in... you guys did the video jointly, right? The Vesica Thoth video?
Yeah.
I watched that last night. And I noticed that was kind of a theme of what you guys were talking about. So, I don't know, did you want to explore that a little bit?
Yeah, as David noticed, which like I didn't even notice before, but I thought it was great that he noticed that the Wheel of Fortune card in Crowley's deck has who's the one holding the Ankh upside down?
So I realized something, and it's what it is, and there's nothing I can really do about it at this point, but. There was actually two videos, and I was asked to make to include a reference to Will Morgan's Man in the Mirror video, and so there was two recordings, and the one that Alan happened to take for Synchronize was one where I had corrected one thing, and then I corrected another. So that's actually Typhon, and in the video, that's the only real mistake that is in that video is that I say that it's Anubis when in fact it's Typhon. And it's an honest mistake. If you look at him, he looks like an Egyptian. There, you can see that they're Egyptian, and then it appears that it's the dog, but it's actually the half alligator, which is a mix of Anubis. If I recall correctly, Typhon is a conglomerate of gods. So it's not too much of a stretch because he's included in the character. But yeah, he holds an Egyptian Ankh face downwards. And so when you look at the Vesica arrangement, it becomes really interesting to notice that you have above the hangman, right before Lust, in Fortune, is an Ankh face downward. And then in the hangman, you have the hangman is literally hanging from this Ankh. And so... that's a really interesting kind of to see it directly. That's the thing, is that all of this stuff is visual, and so when I made the recording, you know, it was in the hopes that people would know what I was talking about, but Patrick really helped me, because now you can literally see, like, directly, like, oh wow, yeah, there it is. So
well, an interesting thing I noticed in the video was you've made a connection with the Fool, or you liken the Fool to the heart, or the Fool connects the hand to the mind, or something like that. And that reminded me of some studies that have been done where there's some evidence for basically the intelligence of the heart, where the heart seems to register ECG, electrocardiogram signals, before the brain... actually receives the signal. So it actually seems like the heart is actually making decisions for you before your conscious mind or even your subconscious is able to weigh in on it.
Yeah.
So it speaks to a more holistic intelligence where you have to think with your mind, but think with your heart and find the middle ground between the two and how they communicate. So it's, you know, there's some lab evidence for that kind of idea, if that's what you guys were getting at. I'm not so sure, though.
Oh, yeah. No, well, that's the thing. So real evidence exists for that. I love what you're saying right now, because, like, I learned about that in massage school. We learned about actual studies that were done about the electromagnetic field for the brain versus the heart. And yeah, it's true. It's shown that there's a much larger field for the heart than there is the mind, which goes against what a lot of philosophers would have to say of old, you know?
Yeah, and what's interesting about the heart and the brain is that they actually, as an embryo, they start off as the same cluster of cells. And then the brain actually migrates from the sac where the heart stays, but then these cells migrate to the cranial area, and that's where the brain starts to form. But they start from the same locus or the same monad or something. So they come from the same unity. And so, you know, with non-local connections and entanglement, it's besides being in the same organism, there's all kinds of connections that you could theorize about what's going on there, plus the link up of between fields and whatnot.
Yeah. I think if I recall correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick, but the rationale for that had to do with the relationship between the fool and adjustment, being that adjustment corresponds to the Hebrew letter lamed, which means ox goad, which is what you use to steer an ox to till a field. And ox is, so ox relates to the Hebrew letter aleph, which relates to the fool. So there's this relationship that exists, and if you look at the letter lamed for adjustment, you can see that it's in the shape of an erect serpent. And so there seems to be kundalini implications in what's being communicated. And so yeah, I find that it's really interesting that you have the thing that steers the ox is literally a serpent. And so that's kind of the idea, is that kundalini, you know, has to awaken the heart and it has to awaken the mind and connect the two energetically.
Yeah, I think we have like a pretty myopic sense of what consciousness is. And so I think, yes, much of it is concentrated in the brain or in and around the brain or outside the brain. There's a synergy there, but we don't consider the rest of the body as our kind of, is factoring into that equation. Yeah, we know that it's a sense perception device, but we don't give the body itself a type of intelligence. And so it goes back to the whole idea of, again, are we reducing ideas and concepts too much? Are we not adopting a more holistic idea of the universe and people in general? So I think it speaks to that pretty pretty strongly.
Yeah. So tell us a little more about some of your recent findings, Patrick, in your blog, because I think that there's probably some interesting rabbit holes we could go down if we were to do that.
The last post I did, which was 2 or 3 weeks ago, which was actually something I had been working with for about 6 months or so, regarding the similarities between Rosemary's Baby and Lolita, in that Lolita takes place in 1962, well, the film does. It came out in 1962, so it's safe to assume that it takes place in 1962, and it takes place over the span of 4 years. And at the end of the movie, they're in 1966, and Lita is pregnant, and she types a letter to Humbert, and it's dated March 19th. And a week later, he comes and visits her. So it's like late March, and she says that she's due in 3 months, which would be late June, which is when Rosemary had her baby, late June 1966. So, you know, I'm seeing all these parallels between these two concepts. And I just kind of went off on that, and there's a lot more connections between the actors, like James Mason. He played Humbert in Lolita. And he was in, like, you know, The Boys from Brazil with Gregory Peck. And Gregory Peck was a father figure in The Omen when he adopted the demon child.
Sure. When the oranges fall down the stairs.
Yeah, there's a lot more connections. Like Shelley Winters, who was Lolita's mother, she's in, she was the concierge in Polanski's film The Tenant. And have you seen that, David?
No, I don't think I've seen that.
I just saw it for the first time a few days ago, and it is really good. You really got to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, Polanski, he rents a room where a previous tenant, it was this young woman, and she jumped out the window to commit suicide. Shelley Winters is the concierge in that film, so she's sort of like this mother figure to this young woman jumping out a window, you know, which is what Rosemary's Friend does in Rosemary's Baby.
She ends up, she's the one who lands on the Volkswagen Beetle covered in blood at exactly where John Lennon was killed, and in Rosemary's Baby. And so, yeah, it's very strange, this window leaping business. Especially like, you know, when we're relating it to what we're talking about here, it's like, I can't help but think of Hay and the fact that you have Yud Hay Vav Hay is literally two windows connected.
Yeah.
Cause Vav is a connecting piece. It means nail. It connects things together.
Yeah.
And so you have this idea of two windows. Very, very strange. I mean, I also was looking at Johnny Depp in Secret Window, mm-hmm. which is a Stephen King story, is very relatable to the Ninth Gate.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's like, hey, it is the Secret Window. I mean, that's the idea. So it's kind of interesting.
And then you've got the door, you've got the Manson door.
Uh-huh, Dalit, right. And so that's the Empress. And so it's like as if they wrote pig on the Empress, so to speak, symbolically. Very strange. I mean, the thing about the Empress and the door is that that's what connects Chokhmah and Bina. So you have wisdom and understanding are bridged through the Empress. And that's the reason why you see the river running through the Empress card traditionally in like the Rider Tarot, and you see the ocean behind the High Priestess, which crisscrosses it to form a cross, right? And then that's the bridge of the abyss.
Yeah.
If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting or being lied about.
From what I gather, that whole deal started, like, I honestly feel like the reason that that film is called If is because of Rudyard Kipling's poem for his son. And I feel like there's a huge argument for that, especially because he's, you know, this English man who's living in India when the English are occupying India. And that poem written for his son is so idealistic. But, that's the premise of that poem. It's like it's like putting this person into various circumstances that make it next to impossible to actually embody what that poem is suggesting. And so, and it's almost like mocking how impossible it actually is when we're living within what we're living within. It's like an unbelievable standard, right? And so that's like, you have this boys' school that's just the most absolutely unjust, fucked up situation imaginable in certain ways. It's like a prison, basically. They're in a kind of a hopeless position as far as the hierarchy is concerned. And so I feel like that's what's going on. And if you look at like A Clockwork Orange and A Lucky Man, it's the same principle being applied. It's like this impossible way to meet the circumstances of life, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
In all three movies, there's at least one part where he's trying to be, you know, like an altruist or, you know, like a good person, and then it just doesn't work. You know, everyone still like does something really negative to him.
Yeah, they use him, and they like, and then it's when he goes with the homeless in Oh Lucky Man, he's trying to feed the homeless and then they attack him, and how fucking relatable that is to when the homeless attack Alex in A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, when he gets out of prison, you know, they gave him like a little bit of money or something, and the first thing he does is he donates it to the Salvation Army, and then they the people standing there, they pick his pockets, and the Salvation Army guy, who is actually Grady from The Shining, instead of like, I don't know, he thanks him, but then what the next thing he does is he starts condemning him for being a sinner and, you know, all this stuff. And like, yeah, through these three movies, Malcolm McDowell's character just can't win.
I was actually just talking to a guy about this, and I actually just wrote an essay on it like a week or two ago, where I feel like we're almost living in kind of Inception, or, you know, it's not the Matrix, it's not literal or anything, but it's an analogy. In both those movies, if the rest of the people realize that you are kind of a intruder, or you're someone outside the paradigm, or you're trying to do stuff contrary to how the system operates, then everyone just kind of like turns on you and attacks the messenger, so to speak. So you actually have a message of liberation, or your actions are emblematic of what people should aspire to. But because people are largely ruled by fear and indecision and settle into patterns and habits, that there's an discomfort by seeing that kind of action or that kind of person. Mm-hmm. And so they almost is like an immune system gone wrong attacking its own body. We're kind of within that. We're living that paradigm. We're living that story right now. And I can see it changing at some point. Maybe we're destined to kind of evolve out of that. But as is, I think what you guys are talking about is definitely speaking to that point, pretty matter-of-factly.
Yeah, did you notice? I thought it was interesting how Jeremy Bullock, the name of the actor, who actually played Boba Fett in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, he's the guy that gets in the car accident in the beginning of the film. He smiles at Travis when he passes him, like kind of like a recognizing smile. And this is the beginning of the film, so it's like, why does this guy recognize him? And then at the end of the film, he's the one that hands Travis the flyer to audition for whatever he's auditioning for at the very end of the film. And so, and he's the guy that was turned into the goat man at the laboratory, which happens right at the end of the first half, so it's like sort of the middle of the film. So you've got the Boba Fett guy at the beginning, the middle, and the end. And in the beginning, he recognizes Travis. And so I have this sort of theory that the second half is sort of like a mirror version of the first half.
Totally.
Or maybe that it loops, you know, and like McDowell's the only one that doesn't realize it's looping.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was interesting that the movie splits in half right as Travis and Patricia are in union. You know, they meet in the back of that van and they, you know, they start making out, and then it's the end of part one. And then part two starts out like the morning when they're waking up in the back of the van.
Interesting.
Back to the idea of it being a dream. Yeah, I just thought it was interesting that, yeah, like you said, some of these characters seem to know what's going on, but McDowell's character doesn't, or maybe he's playing a part or something, because exactly. At the end of the film, he's auditioning for If you noticed. Like Lindsay Anderson, the director of If and A Lucky Man, he's the guy that he plays the role of the director at the audition. So the way I was seeing it is it's sort of like a looping trilogy. It's like at the end of A Lucky Man, he's auditioning for If and A Clockwork Orange, and then you can start back at the beginning of If, you know?
All right. Everybody in?
Hello?
I think so.
Hi. All right, so now's your go, Jason, to rant and rave and to use a lot of curse words.
I will just let you talk about whatever interests you.
Okay, well, I would love to talk about your most recent blog. I found it really interesting. And because you and Patrick and ultimately myself are working on very similar lines, I think it'd be great to... We don't have to necessarily get into the nitty-gritty unless if that's where it leads, but I think it would be nice to kind of do kind of an overview of where you're coming from with your interpretation of things.
I guess the overriding thesis is about the Beatles being sort of a kind of echo of the apostolic era of the first century, with them being the four evangelists of the coming age. Would be it in a very small nutshell.
I just visualized.
I think Timothy Leary was the one who said that.
Oh, he made a statement that says that?
That they were the four evangelists of the new age.
Oh, I actually...
It's in love.
Now that you mention it, I feel like I remember reading that somewhere at one point. That's interesting.
Yeah, I noticed that. I have that somewhere. I just don't know where.
It's the whole implication that John Lennon is the son of the devil that is maybe a bit disturbing to some people, probably. But that's the implication when you put all of these various threads together. And so there is like a metaphorical aspect to that of like the fall of man being the fall of Lucifer as well. And into the descending, descend into the earth. And then we had the Hell's Angels kind of orchestrating that whole, dividing the body of the green man as Meredith Hunter down at Altamont.
So you guys, have you seen the photographs of George Lucas at Altamont? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Photographs of him there?
Yeah. So
I haven't seen photographs of him there, but yeah. I heard he was one of the cameramen.
I had a friend that I wanted to have on the show at some point who basically has researched the hell out of Altamont. And George Lucas was filming Altamont. And he didn't get the stabbing shot. Somebody else got that. But there's like photographs where you can see that he had laid down tarp in a certain area, and it's totally George Lucas. And so I find that really like what?
Yeah.
Because he's right there at the stage, and it's like he's filming it. And so the idea that gets presented from conspiracy theorists talking about Altamont, that it's a staged event. That they're looking to basically create, like, if Woodstock was the sun, you know, what is it? Wasn't it like a week of Woodstock was like the Apollo missions and the Tate murders, the Bianca murders. And so it's just very strange, being that if you see that as like the, you know, if Woodstock is the sun and Altamont is the moon, so to speak, or the diminution of the moon, like it's a dark mass version of whatever Woodstock was. It's like the flip side of the coin.
Like Apollo Dionysius type thing.
Yeah, like there's the idea that they move the stage further down for these purposes, and that there's kind of like they wanted to create a bad trip, and they spread the STP throughout the crowd, you know, like in Woodstock when they're like, don't anyone take the brown acid, you know, it's like everybody at Altamont had taken the brown acid, like, and it smelled like fucking burned rubber from people who were there.
Orange, there was orange sunshine at Altamont, wasn't there?
Yeah, and that's the idea. I mean, it's like they're basically taking...
Right, the Clockwork Orange Sunshine, where there are all little Alexes, you know, just tearing away the fire from the High Priestess.
Jason, you mentioned, I didn't know if you were serious or not, but you mentioned Meredith was attempting to assassinate Mick Jagger.
Well, he's the king killer, and Jagger, I just happened to notice a passage in the Zohar, or a footnote in the Zohar, that talks about jagged as referring to like cutting. Huh. And so there's the whole cutting thing where they're cutting the green man.
Right.
Hmm.
And so he's the hunter trying to kill the king or kill the singer.
Ooh, yeah. Because that was sort of like just a little theory of mine. I didn't know if that was actually his intent or not.
I don't know what the film is called, but there is a film from the 1960s with Mick Jagger, where it is literally a assassin mind control film. Do you know what I'm talking about? What is that called?
It was in an old post. And there was also the thing where Mick Jagger wanted to play Alex in A Clockwork Orange.
Right.
Oh, really? Well, so Mick Jagger was going to be in Lucifer Rising, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, right. And Marian Faithfull is in that movie as well. And so she's like Lucifer's flame again. As the red-haired girl.
Oh. And she's the only person to actually perform a duet live with the Beatles in the 60s.
And with David Bowie.
Right. And I found it interesting that she recorded her duet with the Beatles. She sang the last half of Yesterday. They filmed that on November 1st, 1965, which is the day Rosemary writes Blood on her calendar.
Oh, no. Okay, so that I couldn't believe that. So there's the reoccurring 111 like crazy through all of this, you know, the Time Life Buildings 111, the 111 on Johnny Depp's face, and the Ninth Gate, you know, it's Aleph, right? So that date that she writes with the, it's the 4th and the 5th, how did you, what was the deal? Patrick?
She writes, she circles 4 and 5 in October, which is the value of Adam.
Right.
And then she writes Blood on November 1st.
So 1st. So we're always going back to that riddle of man as being this kind of fallen, evil god.
Yeah, it comes with the fall. It's really driven home is the thing, so...
Yeah, basically, in this post I've been working on, I'm kind of getting at how McCartney and Lennon resonate as these sort of messiah or Osirian figures, you know, and it's sort of similar to what Jason was getting at in his latest post. So
I don't understand. It wasn't my understanding. And correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick, and I very well might be, when you're making these connections, you're not necessarily asserting that Sharon Tate's baby is ultimately the moon child that's being spoken to. Is that your
idea? No. I have no idea as far as that, and I don't even have a theory. But yeah, go ahead.
Those are the two daggers of Peter and Judas, where... The Peter dagger is the satanic child, and then the Judas dagger brings the moon child. Satan's kind of involved.
Where is that? What are you? You're talking New Testament.
Yes.
Excuse me, but I.
That's not in the New Testament. It's something Carlos Suarez kind of wrote about.
Oh, okay. Because I was like, I don't recall that. Expert.
Well, Jesus calls Peter Satan.
Right. Get behind me, Satan.
New Testament. Yeah, and then Judas is also called Satan. So there's the two Satans.
I see what you're saying. Okay, interesting. Huh. So now we're going okay, interesting. I like, what is it, so it's James and John who approach Jesus and say, we want to sit on your right and your left hand of the throne, and then you know, it is not up to me, it is for the one, you know. It's you know, kind of like many are called, but few are chosen kind of thing. And Jesus is like, I'm not the one choosing, so to speak. I have this whole thing with, Jim Morrison and John Lennon sharing one's death day as one's birthday, and kind of this idea of like wanting to sit at the right and left hand of the throne. Seems like they both kind of had that type of aspiration in a sense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? It's kind of far out, but
I'll think about it, man.
Getting back to what we were saying about the devil a few minutes ago, Carl Jung was talking about how the age of Pisces, or you know, the Christian era, was ruled by the age of Pisces, or the zodiac of Pisces, and there's two fish. He equated one fish with the Christ figure and the other fish with the Antichrist figure.
Right.
And by that he meant Christ as a spiritual enlightenment and Antichrist as a sort of a Promethean, Luciferian, intellectual enlightenment. He wasn't saying it's a bad thing. They're just two different kinds of enlightenments. And he says that the spring point of the constellation entered the Antichrist aspect of the fish around the 16th century, around the time of the Reformation and the Renaissance. And so he said, he was saying that's where we have been since around that time. So yeah, there's sort of like these two inherent opposites in that sign, which is sort of how I was tying this all together.
Huh. Yeah, that's trippy. And so the fish, so like, I know that the Hebrew letter Nun originally meant serpent and came to mean fish. And so there's been a fish-serpent connection. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that? I think it's, I don't know if it's the Chaldean or what, or just a Phoenician or how that came to be. But that's the consensus amongst scholars, I guess, is that it's literally a serpent, which is interesting when you think of like Ophiuchus and whatnot. But I don't really know.
Yeah. And okay. And so there's always that serpent lying in the dust, and we saw that with Godzilla recently, being found down in Argentina.
All right.
Is that in the new Godzilla?
Down there in the dust.
In the new Godzilla, he's found in Argentina.
Yeah.
Interesting. Did you watch
the Martian dust? The what?
You watched the new Godzilla?
No.
Okay. You just know that. Because that's where on another note, that's what just came out recently with Hitler. You know about that? The FBI file got released.
What?
That basically Hitler was living in Argentina. That he moved to Argentina. And
right, that's the story.
Yeah. seem legit. Wouldn't surprise me one bit, especially like, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if the FBI just let him go, you know.
Well, right. So the lizard in Argentina is Hitler, esoterically speaking. It's that hidden evil.
Huh. Interesting.
And then you tie back into the boys from Brazil.
Yes, the boys from Brazil is the same Rosemary's Baby thing of the little Hitler child.
Yeah.
Being endlessly cloned.
Yeah, they made 94 Hitler clones, and they're waiting for one to become the new Hitler for the new era, which I thought was weird, you know, because then you've got the 93 Hitler clones that are left over.
Oh, shit.
Go ahead.
Just real quick, just to, it might be a pretty loose connection, but wasn't it to connect the fish and the serpent? If the serpent reflects some kind of enlightenment or something like that, I think it was the Dogon who said that the fish people came from Sirius and basically brought them the roots of Egyptian civilization, and then they migrated to, you know, the the Nile area, and that was basically where a lot of this comes from. So there's a book, it's called Sirius Mystery, and I think it delves into that, and it delves into their cosmology and questions, you know, where they got this information, because a lot of their cosmology actually mirrors stuff from quantum physics, which, you know, some of the connections are loose, but some of their symbolism and artwork is very telling. I mean, it basically predicted the structure of DNA well before, you know, it was discovered by or rediscovered by Crick. A lot of their artwork reflects, if you see modern pictures of the wave function, they're often like petal forms because the particle is never in one place at once. So there's just spread out distributions of where it might be. So they form these very interesting pictures and patterns. And a lot of their pictures and artwork also reflects that. So it's just interesting that that there's those little connections too. And I don't know if you guys, that sparks anything in your imagination, but I just thought I'd bring it up.
Yeah, right. That connects to the Oannes figure, which then connects back to John as being a form of Oannes as the water baptizer in some very strange way that I haven't looked at much, but it seems significant somehow.
So the idea with John that he stated when, you know, everyone was so angry with him for the statement that he made about rock basically being bigger than Jesus, that Christianity will die off. His explanation for that was a specific book, The Passover Plot, which I find incredibly interesting that would interest him, being that the premise of that book is Jesus basically doing everything he can to, like, he's aware of a prophecy, and through his own will, he's basically sabotaging himself so that he can basically play out this archetype. to the full extent. And if you look at, you know, John Lennon, it's like kind of apparent that he identified himself in a very similar fashion. Like, he basically wanted to, you know, he wanted to die. He's so suicidal, you know, as the song goes, you know. It's like he's almost looking to make himself into a Christ figure by letting something play out and basically being the sacrificial lamb, so to speak.
And then if you look at Charles Manson's whole career, it's just like a parody of Christianity, where he is kind of prophesying this apocalyptic war between the blacks and the whites as this kind of Manichaean conflict between light and darkness, in which he will emerge victorious after the apocalypse as the ruler of the world. And so it's like this whole parody of the Jesus in the New Testament, who has similar megalomaniacal aspirations and has a cadre of loyal girls following after him, and is thought to be this great leader who preaches love even while killing people.
Right. Well, that's the thing, and that's what I don't get. Like, I might be upsetting for some people who are very attached to their Christian views, you know.
Everything in my post is upsetting. It's like John Lennon's the devil and Jesus is a liar.
Yeah, totally. But I mean, it's just, I don't get it. It's like, it's one thing that Christianity did really well was like getting people to accept, you know, the death penalty. Like basically that this is your salvation, is to submit to the powers that be, you know, pay your taxes, and you know.
I think
I think some of those ideas are what fuel like Joseph Atwell's thesis and stuff like that, because it's so it does kind of promote this, you know, let them step all over you kind of ideal, and turn the other cheek is certainly important, because you could, you know, fight day and night and not change, and you're almost perpetuating the same paradigm. But at the same time, there's got to be some middle ground between standing up for yourself and then also pursuing your own death. It's a little strange.
Yeah, I mean, he's silent, you know. It's like, and then the chance that he has to speak in court, he's like telling them what the Son of Man will do. And the Son of Man, that's the Joseph Atwell thesis. And I don't agree with a lot of things that Atwell has to say, but that's one of those things that's very questionable. It's like, the Son of Man, well, who's the fuck? Like, basically everything you're saying the Son of Man will do is what Titus Caesar ends up doing. Titus Caesar is actually the correct pronunciation, I've been told now. it's kind of strange. I don't completely, like, I don't know. It's hard for me. Like, he's the messenger for the one that is to come. And you have Christians all talking about the second coming of Christ, but he says he's not the one. You know, there's one who will come, and he's the Son of Man, and he'll come in the clouds, and this is how Jerusalem will fall. And it's like, wait, what? Who are you a messenger for? You know?
It's a helter skelter, man.
Yeah, it seems like it. Yeah, it's really weird. And I mean,
like Charles Manson's on trailer, and I was just like, this guy's just crazy. But everyone's following him. And so that's the nakedness of the situation.
Yeah, I mean, I can't get behind all this kind of Laurel Canyon kind of conspiratorial fanaticism, like, altogether, but there's certain aspects of it that feel undeniable to me. These people came from military families. They present it like, oh yeah, well, Jim Morrison didn't have any skill, and then overnight, all of a sudden, he had some skill, and it's like, as a singer, and it's like, no, dude, he faced the away from the crowd for how long before he was actually able to, like, you know, he had incredible stage fright, like, and continued to have stage fright for like a long fucking time, and so it's just they're. Some of their ideas that get presented, I have a hard time with, but I'm sure you guys are probably familiar with that thesis that's been presented that people kind of push, like this, like that it's just a Tavistock kind of experiment, and that's all there is to it. The Beatles didn't write their own music, you know, this kind of thing. It's like, I have a hard time buying that. I think they wrote their stuff. You can see that they wrote their stuff, you know. Whether or not they're doing PR in the midst of that is pretty undeniable. Some form of PR, kind of like a cult PR, so to speak.
I guess the real conspiracy is always in how we turn things into idols to be worshipped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a more insidious form of conspiracy.
Totally. Well, that's kind of what happened, right? I mean, and that wasn't even them. Like, all these things weren't even really them. Like, I don't think that they chose when their records would come out, and that's one of the really suspicious things. You know, you have their second record comes out the day and year that Kennedy's killed, and then, you know, the 5-year anniversary of Kennedy's death is when the White Album's released. Like, that doesn't feel like a mistake, but that was, I don't think that was on their part. That was on whoever, you know, is right. their record label, you know. It's kind of weird. And then if you look at, like, you know, the fact that the EP for Magical Mystery Tour came out the same day and year as Her Majesty's Satanic Request, which was the December 8th, which is the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, and then go Rosemary's Baby. That's very strange, right? I mean, that's weird. And I mean, you know, and then that's 9 months before 9/11, and you have, that's like, so what was the thing, 9/11... 1967 was when Manson recorded his album Lie, and then they finished the album on August 9th. Is that how it went?
Yeah, they finished it on August 8th, 1968.
Oh, August
1967 is also the very first David Bowie album, and then Sgt. Pepper 20 years ago today is 1947, which is when David Bowie was born, and that's the Black Dahlia murder and the death year of Aleister Crowley.
Oh, right.
And so that's the whole priesthood right there.
Who was born that year?
David Bowie.
Oh,
in 1947.
Right. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, in 1946 was the Babylon Working, which ended in March 1946. So 9 months after March 1946 is January 1947, which is when the Black Dahlia
right.
murder happened.
Right, because Marjorie Cameron was not a proper Babylon, because a Babylon has to be an earthly avatar of Bina, which means that she has to actually have attained to the sphere of Bina.
Right, but
whereas Marjorie Cameron was just a bunch of elementary spirits, which is what Crowley said in his diary, I guess.
But that's the whole point, right? I mean, isn't that the thing with Marjorie Cameron, that she's like, she's a handmaiden. I don't know about how that would relate to Bina necessarily. I mean, I know that's, I don't know how, I mean, because Bina is the upper Shekinah. I don't
right.
know. So it just seems like it's all cliphotic, and so why would it actually align with the non-cliphotic if that's what it's actually presenting itself as? That's do you see what I'm saying?
Are you talking about the Babylon Working?
Yeah, what I'm saying is, it's like the Babylon Working itself seems to be like it's not meant to be anything non-cliphotic. Like, it's very outright with that,
right? And so that's, I guess, what Crowley's criticism of it was.
Right, and that's the thing that's interesting about Crowley, too, is that he doesn't seem, like, when it comes to that stuff, he's not on the same page as a lot of these people, and I feel like he actually took issue, like, his whole point is to make demons into angels. Like, that's his primary focus, and so that's not something that he, that is ultimately in line with what the traditional rabbis wanted, is to basically reconcile the tree, you know, to basically transmute the alien forces, so to speak, and to purify and cleanse and to purge and all this kind of thing. And so it seems like ultimately, like, that's Crowley's angle. Yet if you look at what's happened with the OTO now, with like Kenneth Grant and whatnot, that it seems like they're not really like they're not adamant about that point anymore.
Well, right. So Crowley was the great beast, and so part of killing the king was having to become the king, and so it's like he had to become the great beast, and so now he just deluded all of his followers into this really bullshit religion where nobody really understands anything about what he was really saying.
Yeah.
Oh, and yeah, and I mean, I go over on the Thelemite forums, and they are just a bunch of idiots.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but it's challenging. Yeah, not altogether.
Kind of what I said about Kubrick as well, where it's like they veil more than they reveal in with these movies, and so you kids can just sit here and just try to pick them apart for your whole lives and. It doesn't necessarily get any closer to the truth, but no. I mean, there's truth in them, but no, you could spend your whole life just looking at them.
Yeah. That's kind of what
from the outside.
We were having when Patrick was visiting, we were having a discussion with my teacher and Patrick was pointing out that in Her Majesty's Satanic Request, you have this unsolvable maze, you know? And I felt like that unsolvable maze is like a perfect metaphor for what, trying to understand what's going on with the Clefotic side of things. It's like, this is a mystery that's not meant to be revealed because it's like, it doesn't actually lead anywhere ultimately on its own terms, that it's just in the nature of thought too. Cause it's like the thing is basically it's like a feedback loop or an infinite recursion. And you don't necessarily reach an end through that. The point is to transcend, you know, through the middle path, so to speak. But that's not like on its own terms, it can't be understood. And that's what makes it a challenge. Like here we are, we're trying to discuss these matters and we're doing the best we can. But like that's something that needs to be understood from the get-go to the best of one's ability, that what the puzzle it is that we're working with isn't meant to be a solvable puzzle. If anything, it's just designed in such a way to push you out of it, if you're willing, you know, if that makes sense. Because as far as I can tell, this isn't to be solved on its own terms.